From UFOs to ghosts and government cover-ups, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello. Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
I'm Ben, and as always, we are here with, gosh, Noel, the nickname got so long last time we were podcasting, remember?
Did it?
Yeah, we had this thing where we would need trumpets, and then we would need somebody.
Oh, there was going to be a minstrel with a lute and a carpet of some sort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it was Awesome Town, Noel Brown.
I think we can dispense with the nicknames if you want. I mean, it's okay if something comes up and it's, mm-hmm. Meaningful, but don't have to do it, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a weird psychological thing, right? It's always fun to do something when you don't have to. And when you were a kid, did you ever want to mow the lawn? And then you eventually had to mow the lawn?
Oh, yeah.
Was that just me? No, that was you too?
No, I got you.
Yeah, okay, you see what I'm saying. Well, we're talking about happiness in a way. So there's a very interesting thing that happens with happiness. There's a comparative factor to happiness, and it's very strange. You could have two people, right? Two people. One is a guy making 30 grand a year, doing whatever he does. Give him a fake job. What's he do?
Lawnmower.
He's a lawnmower. And one who mows lawns.
Lawnmower man.
Yeah, he's a lawnmower man. And he makes $30,000 a year. If everybody else in his... Oh, and there's this other person. She makes $50,000 a year. What does she do, Matt?
She makes podcasts.
Okay,
That's a lot of money for making podcasts.
That's a lot of money. Okay, so we've got this podcaster lady making 50 a year and this lawnmower guy making 30. If all of the other people at the lawn mowing company make like $25,000 or even $28,000, this guy is the king of the mountain. He is thrilled to be alive. Things taste sweeter.
How did he find out what everybody else makes?
Let's just say he did for the sake of it.
Okay, okay, gotcha.
But if the lady making $50,000 at the podcasting thing finds out that her coworkers are making, $55,000, right? Mm-hmm. Or 53 even, then she is going to be miserable and unhappy. And that's because for a great deal of the human species, happiness is so comparative. And there are other studies about whether money makes you happy, whether it really buys happiness. Mm-hmm. It turns out that that's true up to a certain point. In the U.S. at least. And then after that, it doesn't matter as much.
I mean, what you're describing to me is I've always thought of as sort of like that grass is always greener kind of mentality, sort of like you look at what other people have, keeping up with the Joneses or the Smiths or whatever mm-hmm. generic American last name you'd like to use for this
sure.
analogy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm guilty of it, but you definitely have to like, it's a good thing to keep yourself in check over because it's very easy to like start coveting what other people have mm-hmm. when you realize at the end of the day, it wouldn't necessarily make you happier if you had it.
That's a great point because that comparative stuff works a couple of different ways. Listeners, you probably have had the same experience that almost every kid has growing up in the West where a parent or an authority figure says, well, think of the people who have less than you do. Or someone says, it could be worse. My mother used to say all the time, and I just hated it. It can be worse. Doesn't make anything. It doesn't change anything. It could be worse is just like, also, you shouldn't be upset about these horrible things. And it's strange because when we think about our unhappiness or problems in relation to the larger field of humanity, we have such a disconnect, like we were talking about this briefly off air and I think you alluded to it, Noel. What are the problems that?
Oh yeah. We were just discussing problems that we're having in our daily lives right now. My main one is that my kid poops on me occasionally. That's gross. I don't like that. It's horrible, but really that's one of my biggest problems right now. I mean, that's messed up.
Yeah.
That is messed up for me to even – I don't know. It makes me feel horrible. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because maybe my mom kind of gave me some of the same things. She wasn't doing it for any bad reason. It was for a really good reason to think about other people, have empathy. Imagine yourself sure. if you don't have all the things that you have now. But it definitely weighs on me pretty heavily.
The pooping?
No, the I think that my problems are bad sometimes, right? And I really kind of wallow in what I'm dealing with. Mm. But then if I pull myself out a little bit, I just realize how ridiculously great I have it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I have a 6-year-old daughter, and the perfect way to sum up these, like, first world problems is to observe the behavior of a 6-year-old.
Okay.
So she's constantly like, we're in a store and she's like, I want that thing. And I'm like, why do you want it? She's like, well, because it looks cool and because I feel as though I need that and deserve that. Oh. And I have to say things like, and I never thought I would be this, but I am like, why don't you not worry about what you don't have and just think about what you do have and appreciate that, you know, and let's go from there.
Oh, man.
That's amazing.
Doesn't work though.
No.
not hearing it. And you know, I mean, she's not a super tantrum type kid, mm-hmm. but she definitely, you know, she's got some wants. Mm-hmm.
So does she
shut it down?
Does she get the things?
No.
Or you just like, no, we're getting out of here.
I'm not giving it.
She's really smart though, and she's kind of villainous. One time she told me I had made a powerful enemy when I wouldn't give her a Fanta.
Oh, wow.
That never happened.
Okay.
Somebody
did make a powerful enemy recently though, didn't they?
Yeah, I'm still kind of sore about it. I don't want to really into it.
All right.
No,
you could vent.
Maybe when I'm in a better place to talk about it emotionally, but listeners, be absolutely clear, the thing that we're alluding to doesn't matter. In the grand scheme of problems, we are today talking about something that's related to an earlier podcast we did, right? We did the future of inequality. Now we came back to do the future of poverty. And so first we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is poverty? You know, we talked about how people okay, full disclosure for everybody. The slight jump you just heard was an edit because off air, Matt, you convinced me that, if everybody is talking about first world problem, I should talk about one too. It's a little difficult because I am furious. Noel, you might have to edit parts of this because I don't know if I can hold it in. So I think somebody stole some mail from me. I was ordering, full disclosure, I was ordering some comics, a graphic novel set from a series that Noel turned us on to called Lock and Key. And it's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
And I was waiting days. And I'm pretty sure somebody stole it. And there's this strange, you know, the bureaucracy in that movie Brazil?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm going through. I have the packing or tracking number, and I have all my bureaucratic red tape ducks in a row. And these people, they just push you, you know, it's no help. And they're like, well, it says they're saying, oh, well, Ben, it says it was delivered, cause you came and picked it up. And I said, no, I was with myself the whole time. I didn't go anywhere. You know, there's not like sleepwalking. You're right. Anyway, I'm not a somnambulist or whatever.
Well, that's a horrible feeling where you really thought you were going to get it. You were going to get to get back into the story that you've been waiting for. And now it's like, fine.
But it's such a stupid problem to have, you know, considering what I had. This story already encounters so many things we already have, right? Already have a phone where it's possible to call a post office, right? Already have a phone where it's possible to call the people who are supposed to be shipping it. Already had a little bit of extra scratch
mm-hmm.
to get some graphic novels of all things.
An internet connection.
Not
an Amazon Prime account.
Not to mention a shipping service that can send you things.
Oh, yeah, totally. You're right. So I was being very small-minded and brattish and stupid and spoiled. We talked about
being a little hard on yourself, but okay.
Well, we talked about real problems before when we talked about the future of inequality in a previous podcast that you should check out. You don't have to listen to it to understand what we're talking about today, but it will help sort of paint the picture. So people spend a lot of time asking how much money a person needs to live, right? You've seen those mm-hmm. commercials. We've all seen the commercials. You know, it's for $1 a day, right? Yeah. And this leads us to ask, what is poverty? What is poverty? How is it defined? Who's defining it?
I mean, in general, I guess we all basically have an understanding of what poverty is. But, you know, in general terms, it's the state of being poor, not possessing adequate resources, whether in terms of money or basic needs that need to be met, such as food, water, shelter, medical services.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way to say it, because this doesn't one person's poor is another person's, you know, wealth or another person's pension, right?
Yes.
It's wildly different across the world.
Well, yeah, that's one of the hardest things that we found in researching this is that there are institutions that are global that are trying to kind of say, well, if we look at poverty globally, what does it look like? And then you're having to go down to each separate country, each separate region in each country and say, well, what does poverty mean here? Mm-hmm. And then trying to put, say, a dollar amount like the UN does.
Right.
Or the World Bank tries to put a dollar amount a day for how much a person must make or must not make to be considered poor or not.
Right, yeah, because there are degrees of poverty as well. What we're talking about specifically will be extreme poverty. And this is measured, as you said, Matt, in absolute terms, meaning people living on less than a dollar a day. It used to be $1.25 a day. And then went up to $1.90 a day. That's what the World Bank uses as a benchmark for these poverty statistics. And the estimates of this vary widely. But ladies and gentlemen, we are happy to say there is good news, at least at the beginning of this, which is that over time, the percent of the population with extreme poverty has been in decline.
Yeah, that's right. One of the big numbers we were looking at was that in 1981, according to the World Bank, there were, I think, 44% of human beings in the global population were considered to be below the poverty line.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Then in 1990, it was 37%. Then jump all the way up to 2012, and we're currently at 12.7%.
But even that's declining. You know, that's
yes, that's 2012, and
hopefully
we're 2015. I think the most recent estimates. Let's see, 14% in 2015, according to that is the MDG report 2015 summary, which is the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. That's their little summary from the last year that was. We should probably talk about what the Millennium Development Goals are if I'm going to jump that out.
Well, yeah, let's talk about it. So the United Nations, at the suggestion of the then secretary at the time, who I believe was Kofi Annan, decided that they would set forth these broad goals. And one of those goals was the eradication of extreme poverty. They've met some of those benchmarks there, and they're still working on it. But what we're talking about now, as we kick around these statistics, is that if this were a game, the rules of the game are changing while the game is afoot.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
So we see that poverty doesn't necessarily mean the same thing across the planet. But we also see that despite the wide misunderstanding and some of the hidden agendas or alleged hidden agendas that we'll be discussing here, despite all this stuff and despite the dwindling of extreme poverty, the numbers are still bad. Not being in extreme poverty does not mean you are in any way, shape, or form necessarily doing well.
Oh, yeah.
It just means that you're not extremely impoverished. So let's talk about some of those factors. If we talk about the future of poverty, we talk also about the factors affecting poverty, which are not necessarily what you might think, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about the big stuff, right?
One of the factors that I hadn't really thought about and how much effect it would have on poverty globally is climate change and how it's going to basically – I mean, it's going to make a lot more people more poor if you think about rising sea levels, if you think about weather and catastrophes that are going to be occurring at higher and higher frequencies, or at least that are projected to take place at higher frequencies.
I would think, too, it would affect like agrarian economies,
Oh, yeah. Droughts, fires, there are all of these things that are, you know, at least according to the science, being affected by global climate change.
Well, there's a, yeah, that's a good point. There's a double whammy there as well. Like, I know that the ideas circling around environmental catastrophes are often politicized.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just look at it from a geographical place. Here's why I call it a double whammy, because the areas of the world that are being affected most by these things are typically in developing regions of the world, which means that there's not as much infrastructure. The states involved and the people affected don't have some of the same safeguards or safety nets. For instance, in Bangladesh, there's going to be a lot of problems with flooding.
Yeah, there were already a lot of problems, and we kind of saw like what there is to be done internally in Bangladesh and what kind of safeguards there are. And I mean, it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, and you know, some Pacific nations are already worried about sinking under the water within our lifetimes. This could create something that I think is very strange, and I never thought this would happen. Something called climate refugees,
where you have to flee where you currently live in order to either be at a higher elevation or be a place where food is available.
Right, like to your point, Noel, if there's an agrarian economy and people depend upon that for sustenance and livelihood, then when that land is unarable, then they have to go. They can't. There's not another option.
And just quickly, specifically, that study was saying that there could be another 100 million people who, I guess, are included or added to the numbers of those who are in extreme poverty in the next 15 years, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. Those are the places that are most at risk.
Right. Yes. And with that continuing, I think we should also note the future of inequality skyrocketing in certain parts of the world, our country included on that list. But there's this other thing that maybe will make for a different show in the future, but we should talk about it now. Technology, you guys. Times are changing.
Yeah.
A couple of things that this occurred to me around technology. I was listening to an NPR piece on Marketplace a couple of days ago, and I wish I could remember a little bit more specifics about it. But they referenced a stat that was really interesting to me, that folks in lower income brackets are more likely to get into traffic accidents that can cause them serious health problems because they don't necessarily have access to cars with the newest safety features. So if you're not making as much money, you might be driving an older car, you might let things lapse as far as maintenance of that car, and you also might be in a car that doesn't have any of the newer, like, you know, sensors that keep you, that tell you when you're out of your lane, or like, you know, backup cameras, things like that, that tend to add, you know, to the safety of vehicles. And then, so I was Googling that to try to figure out what the study was, and I actually came upon this blog on the World Bank website that said a huge factor, or at least a factor that's a lot larger than you might think, in poverty is automotive accidents. And so it sort of ties in, because a large number of people can actually lose their jobs after serious car accidents for a number of reasons, whether it's, you know, health, they can't perform the functions required to do their jobs anymore.
Sure.
Maybe they weren't insured properly and they are now
in debt,
dealing with all kinds of, you know, medical bills. And it goes on. So it takes longer for victims of road crashes to find jobs because the criteria is going to be much more specific if they actually have suffered serious injuries. And then, you know, there are these huge income gaps between victims of traffic crashes and non-victims. So if, for example, you are at fault in a traffic accident and then you don't have adequate insurance, it can totally ruin your life. You could lose your house. It can spiral out of control. And I mean, I think that is definitely ties into the technology factor, maybe not in the way that you were going with it, but I think it's definitely something to think about. It's interesting.
I think it ties in perfectly because it is something that we don't consider, and it ties into the future of poverty, because in some parts of the world, you have to have some sort of transportation. You can have a car, right, and a cell phone and still be extremely poor, especially in a country where it's a necessity to have those two things. And the other thing that goes on with technology here is increasing automation.
Yep.
Are we going to get to a point where most of the jobs that are done by humans now just don't need to – we don't need those people to work?
It is very strange. I was actually looking at Marshall Brain's website for this, who mm-hmm. is the founder of HowStuffWorks.com, the site for which we work.
He's our Dave Thomas.
Yeah, exactly. Mr. Marshall Brain. Well, he writes about this stuff a lot, about automation and robotics and the future, what it's going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that he says that's going to be, or the first job that's going to be driven out through automation, he says, are truck drivers. Because he thinks there are going to be automated trucks just going all over the United States and delivering everything.
Unfortunately, I mean, it does seem like that's one of those things that is just a matter of time. I mean, we know that self-driving cars exist that are, mm-hmm. In beta testing that are pretty damn good. And, you just scale that technology and, put out a fleet.
Well, but the thing is, that job of being a truck driver, that's actually a fairly, it's not amazingly lucrative, but it's a pretty darn good steady job that you can get.
And it's also a very kind of American job if you think about it. I mean, it's a very kind of grassroots kind of working man's type job.
Well, yeah. So let's take these three large concepts and let's paint the worst hypothetical picture. It doesn't have to necessarily be in the States, but let's say a person, I'll give them a name. And if I use your name accidentally, listeners, I promise it's not on purpose. So let's say Sam, right? Sure. Sam. So let's say that Sam grew up on a farm. Sam grows up on a farm and becomes a truck driver, right? Mm-hmm. And, this is still when people can drive their own trucks. But Sam's not doing that well because it's not paying that well, right? And he can't afford the insurance, the extra price you have to pay just in his private life to have a manually driven car, which is going to be more expensive, right? And that also means that he's at fault if an accident occurs. So an accident occurs and he can't get back into the trucking industry because he has that one strike and trucks are increasingly automated. He's in a John Henry situation. They don't need a human driver. So he goes back to his childhood farm, but it's not there because the desertification has occurred or whatever and the land has eroded. It's no longer arable. And then in this dystopian future, our boy Sam ends up joining millions of other people who have no job. There's no place that will employ them. And we would live in, this sounds like such a sci-fi story, like Black Mirror, but we would live in a place where the only people with power and the only people with jobs are the people who own the machines and repair them.
That's one reason that Black Mirror is so excellent, is because it's incredibly prescient in that way. Mm-hmm. The scenarios that it depicts mm-hmm. are based on very real problems and very real technological situations that are reaching critical mass and that could eventually lead to some dystopian kind of situation. And the way you just described that, it's interesting to me because I think of this as sort of a one day there are truck drivers and one day there are no more truck drivers. But you're right. It would be like a more gradual process mm-hmm. where people would gradually, it would be more and more difficult yeah. to pay for the insurance and to actually, do it the old way. Mm-hmm. Sort of like with cabs and Uber right now, for example.
That's a pretty good point and a disturbing point too. Guys, not all hope is lost for Sam and his countrymen because he lives in a place where yes, there's a crumbling infrastructure. Maybe yes, there's a corrupt government and there's not enough, employment to go around. But what if a friendly international agency dedicated entirely to the elimination of extreme poverty showed up and said, hey, we'll help you out.
Here's the safety net.
Here's the safety net you wanted. Just pay us back and we'll give you some money. It's a loan.
Mm-hmm.
No stress. Just a couple things go along with the loan. Standard business.
Wait a minute. Are you talking about like a mafia-esque organization here?
No.
We are talking about the World Bank.
And we'll get to them in a moment, right after a word from our sponsor.
Here's where it gets crazy. What if the World Bank has a different purpose.
I love that. I thought we were in an episode, video episode just then.
I mean it. I'm being serious, you guys.
Well, I mean, what's, can you give us a little bit more background on the World Bank? I know we've kind of touched on it throughout this episode, but I could use a little bit of a primer.
Yeah. Okay. So the World Bank is an international financial institution. What they do is they give loans to developing countries with the idea that they will increase the economic growth of that country. So this would be stuff like, building a dam, for instance. Here's a loan to build a project of great infrastructure, right? And these loans are attached often with conditions, and these conditions are meant to better the economic state of the country. So, for instance, corruption is a big problem in a lot of developing countries. I mean, it's a big problem everywhere, but it's a big problem in developing countries.
Different types of corruption.
Different types, that's right. And what the bank will do in order to combat that, for instance, would say, well, we need to privatize some of your industries because right now they're state run and corrupt, which is a unfortunately common problem. So with their official goal being the reduction of poverty through this kind of capital investment and capital programs, they are a part of the United Nations. They're a part of the World Bank Group, which is part of the United Nations Development Group. And they've had some hits. They've had some misses. They've been accused at times of pursuing a free market ideology, that flies in the face of results. So making the error of a lot of passionate, motivated, smart people. Which is to say, I know what will work, and so I'll do this because I know the result, even though I haven't done it before. Or even though I've done it before in the exact same way and it had a horrible result, I'm going to do it again.
Well, yeah, because it might work this time.
It might work this time. Well, in part of this, too, to be completely fair, and these are huge problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is not something that any group could get right all the time.
Well, yeah, you're trying on a global scale to fix economies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's – I don't know if there are many more lofty goals besides getting humans to Mars.
Or are they, Matt? Are they trying to fix the economy?
Well
– that's the question.
There are people on, let's say, the outskirts who would say no. They're actually trying to perhaps destabilize certain areas of the world, mm-hmm. to go in and maybe gain a little more control for a global institution like the World Bank. Again,
right.
That's on the fringes.
Mm-hmm.
Can we circle back to our hypothetical farmer situation?
Yeah, Sam, let's check in on Sam. Okay, so, Sam is one of the people affected.
He's been displaced. His trucker job is no more.
Right. His trucker job is no war. The farm's gone.
Coming back to the homestead, nothing.
Nothing.
Barren.
Tumbleweeds, man. And so the World Bank comes in. There aren't any roads. They're all in disrepair. There could be some potential to make new farmland with some irrigation projects, right?
And but we need money for that.
Right. We need money for that, and we need expertise. We need engineers because a lot of the engineers have left the country for better-paying jobs elsewhere. There was a brain drain.
Mm-hmm.
So the World Bank comes in and says says, we'll give you this loan. We'll build this infrastructure project. And we will increase the GDP of the country, right? The gross domestic product. We will, kickstart the economic growth. This country will go from stagnating to developing again. And one day, who knows, baby? You could be Singapore. I don't know if that's, I don't know if Pacino is in the World Bank.
Is that the benchmark? Is that the target?
Singapore is a little authoritarian, but it's a pretty clean country, apparently. So here's where things start to go wrong. They say, well, while we're building this dam and this irrigation project that's going to bring this farmland back, you, Sam, and all your neighbors have to move. Get out. It's called.
Well, yeah, we need this area to work, right? I mean, you got to get out of here.
Are we going
to
at least pay you out, though? Is that how we roll?
Ideally, but what if Sam says, I don't want to go? Then Sam will be forcibly relocated. At least this happened before where people are forced to get out. And yeah, it can happen in any situation. You know, a state can, in many cases, impose itself upon private property, mm-hmm. right? It happens in the states.
Sure.
Yeah. What's it called?
Eminent domain.
Yeah. AKA the reason that the roads can widen into your yard, right?
Sure.
So here are some of the criticisms that people will say, including, and these aren't necessarily your typical idea of a anarchist or a conspiracy nut. One of the more ardent critics of the World Bank is its former chief economist, Joseph Stiglitz.
I thought you were going to say Stalin.
Nope. His former Joseph Stalin.
Sorry.
So this is, you'll hear people argue on both sides. You'll hear some people, I read a very interesting thing where a guy accused the World Bank of being a socialist collectivist thing. And then other criticisms, of course, more criticism with it being too far into like a neoliberal idea of the free market economy, right? That the invisible hand will guide people to civilization. But Stiglitz said that the policies the bank implements happen too quickly, and it's referred to as shock therapy, but it's in the wrong sequence, and that the bank ends up prizing GDP over anything else. So if there's a higher GDP, that doesn't necessarily – when the economy is good for a country, it doesn't necessarily mean the economy is good for the people in that country, right? And I'm not arguing for any political thing. That's just a fact. Mm-hmm. And so Stiglitz is saying that these two ideas should not be conflated. And what he's saying is he's saying there's maybe a degree of – honest error in the implementation of these policies. But then other people are saying, no, the the IMF and the World Bank function as these tools of control, as a way to keep other states in subservient positions, or even to practice resource extraction. And it's strange because the IMF and the World Bank cracked something called the Washington Consensus, which is where they decided that the World Bank would also institute these policies of privatization, deregulation, stuff like that. Stiglitz objects to it and says that it hasn't worked out, that it's more of people wanting a nice idea to be true. And maybe they're doing it the wrong way. He, for instance, says that the Chilean success — a lot of people who are proponents of the Washington Consensus believe that Chile is a success story economically because of World Bank IMF policy. Stiglitz, however, says that it's because they had state ownership of key industries, particularly its copper industry. So the state still owned the resources. And of course, other people wildly disagree that that's why it happened. But that's the thing about the dismal science of economics. You know,
yeah.
People can argue back and forth all day.
Well, I can see that argument where if Chile owned the copper industry in their country, they could use money coming in from that to perhaps bolster certain parts of their economy, mm-hmm. right? Help some things out internally rather than having this giant loan from the World Bank that they're having to pay off anyway.
So this goes back to an earlier thing we talked about before too, which was, do banks run the world?
Yes. Right? Yes.
Matt, you believe in this too.
I see the strings everywhere, man.
I think there's a lot of undue influence there, but it's, you know, we've seen that it's difficult outside of apparently Iceland. It's difficult to regulate banking industries. But I will also say that the World Bank, in my opinion, the World Bank has hardworking people in it, just like in any other industry. And they're trying to make the world a better place. But if we look at the future of poverty, right? And we ask ourselves why there is a larger concentration of poverty in certain places, like sub-Saharan Africa is actually gaining more impoverished mm-hmm. people while the rest of the world is doing a little bit better and better and better. And so I'm wondering, and I'm asking you guys, and I'm asking you listening as well, do you think that the World Bank is a tool of some sort of overarching thing, right? We talked about in our video episode, we talk about different authors who allege that the World Bank is working hand in hand with intelligence agencies. Like, we'll build a dam for you. Or you could probably do a better villain voice.
I'll build a dam for you.
That was great.
I liked that.
I was just kind of piggybacking on, you know, your source material.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating point that we're verging on here, however, because the World Bank has represents over 180 countries. However, it's controlled by a small amount of countries. The president of the World Bank traditionally has always been American, and the president of the IMF traditionally has always been European. And the governing structure of the bank is not democratic. They have this interesting idea, because the funding members of the bank worked out a deal where it's $1, one vote. Therefore, the more money you contribute to the World Bank, the more control you have over the organization. That's why China and India might represent around 40% of the world's population, but only have 5% of the votes at the World Bank. Whereas six countries, the U.S., Canada, Japan, Germany, the U.K., and France, control about 45% of the decision-making power. And it's not required to reveal its internal documents. It can if it wants, but it doesn't have to. I keep talking about the loans as though there is one kind of loan, but there are three. The first is a project loan. And that's where we talk about dams and power plants and copper mines and stuff. The second is a sector adjustment loan. That's where they support specific policy changes in an industrial sector, for instance. And then the third, the one that you hear a lot about when it comes to those changes of deregulation, privatization, and so on, that is the structural adjustment program, the short-term support in exchange for major policy changes. So I don't know. I know this is kind of dry, but this ties into the future of poverty, because we're looking at a world within your lifetime, listeners. We're looking at a world where it's quite possible that poverty becomes eliminated if this group is actually pursuing their goals. You know what I mean? And there are a lot of NGOs trying to do the same thing, non-governmental organizations. But what do you guys think? Like, do you think the critics have some grain of truth in their criticism? Is the World Bank a wolf in sheep's clothing?
Well, there's a lot of fear about global organizations like this. And we spoke about the Millennial Development Goals that the UN had put forward in 2000 that lasted up until 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And this year they got replaced by the Sustainable Development Goals.
Yep.
And I'm just going to read some of these off just to give you an idea of the, let's say, the goals for good that are being put forth by the United Nations. One, no poverty. That's the one that we were talking about, and that was number one at the top of the Millennium Development Goals, which was, and back then it was eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. Now it's just no poverty. We're going to kill it. It's done. Number two is zero hunger, mm-hmm. which is really good. They want to look at good health and well-being, quality education, gender equality, clean water and sanitation, all the way down to climate action, reduced inequality throughout the world. I mean, these are some huge, lofty goals. But as we could see from the Millennium Development Goals, they did pretty well. At least, who knows if the UN, actually did all of the things to cause this in the World Bank. But still, having a global organization with those goals and actively pursuing to rid the world of these terrible things, I mean, I think it's pretty great. But on the same side, on the other side of that coin, I think it is probably not going to be very effective on a global scale.
But yeah, and are these institutions changing the world, or are they just enforcing a neo-colonial status quo, right?
That's a huge possibility.
It's kind of how it feels to me in some sense.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I guess it's just sometimes it's just a matter of sort of shifting the status quo so that it suits those in power and sort of like mm-hmm. allowing them to make it malleable to their own ends. And, you know, I mean, I hate to sound cynical, but a lot of times when I see these big organizations trying to make these big changes and they involve, you know, kind of backroom deal type scenarios, it mm-hmm. makes me wonder, you know, where their motivations actually lie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And then also it's tough to guess because there's obfuscation of the internal documents, right? And it's also tough to guess because it's a new kind of thing. It's one of the first kind of entities mm-hmm. doing this for this long, right? But they've been accused of pursuing ulterior motives repeatedly. And then I'm sure there are multiple sides to the story because, of course, the bank is dealing with corrupt places at the time. But the allegation that the bank itself is corrupt is, I'm just going to say, it's not crazy. It's not crazy that people with a lot of power would play some underhanded
monopoly. Well, and corruption begets more corruption. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're working in a situation where you can get away with something because of, you know, the status quo of that particular situation, certain type of person might take advantage.
Yeah, that's a good point too. So I guess though we have to look at it in a great balance scale. On one side, we have the good that's being done, right? And then on the other side, we have a lot of sketchy stuff. So when do we make the call about when do we make the call about whether this is a good thing or not? And listeners, especially if you're listening in a foreign country, what is your country's experience in these institutions? We want to hear from you. And just to show you how much, oh man, I wish we had time to check all of that listener mail from the last episode.
Oh, we got so much. I actually have a list of all of the people who wrote to us.
You're such a good guy.
I'm just going to read them out at some point. Oh, do we have a selection?
I have
already?
A couple.
I have one in particular that I want to shout out. But thank you everyone for writing to us about sleep paralysis, night terrors, shadow people, all of that stuff. All kinds of just really interesting stories about sleep and what you experience when it happens. Because sleep to us and dreaming, I think the three of us in this room, it's a fascinating subject already. Just the idea that we deactivate for hours and hours and hours at a time every day. Still weird to us. But thank you, Jessica, Liz, Gemma, AJ, Dwayne, Andy, Michael, Sean and Sean O, Vanessa, Tom, Ellie, Jasper, George, Lacey, and finally, Yaya, who did something that I'm not aware anyone else has done so far on this show. It's a first. She sent us a voice message. She was listening to our show in her car, and she pulled over to the side of the road and decided to record a message and sent it to us. Thought that was pretty awesome. So we're just going to go ahead and listen to the story that she's telling about an experience she had back in the day.
Hey guys, so I was listening to the sleep paralysis podcast and while driving, and I heard the story about the guy sleeping with the two girls and then having a weird little episode. And I remember a while ago kind of a similar thing happening to me. So I used to live with my family in a two-story house, and then there was like kind of like three stairs that go down to a lower level, I guess you would say. And my brother, my older brother, he lived in the room down at the lower level of the house. Now, he kept complaining about like weird things happening to him, or he would, wake up and at one point he seen like something extremely like demonic in the corner of his room. And I was just like, you know, I don't believe you at all. Like, this is just crazy. I don't believe you. And the way his room was set up was, there was like a family room downstairs, and then, right connected to the family room was his bedroom. And I remember being like half asleep on the couch, and he looks over at me and he's like, hey, are you sure you want to sleep down here? And I'm like, yeah, why? And he's just like, Okay, well, something's gonna happen. And I'm just like, okay, like this, I just was not believing him at all in any of the stories he said. Anyways, I fall asleep and I don't know how long I was asleep for, but I do remember like opening my eyes and it's a weird sensation to like be awake, but not be awake, not be able to move or get up when you want to get up. It was just the weirdest feeling. It's never happened to me before. And I remember, this man, like, standing, behind me, so I could hear him, I could hear where he was standing, but I couldn't see him, and he was saying, you know, I know you, you don't know me. A lot of people, they say, like, when they see me, it's really, it frightens them, and they get really scared. And then he said, I've been watching you for a while, and he showed me, like, a bunch of pictures of me, like, just doing everyday things, or, like, getting out of the shower, like, really weird. And then he goes, so, do you want to look at me? And I said, no, I don't. Why would I want to? And I just remember like squeezing my eyes shut and like feeling the weirdest force like on my head, like pushing me down and trying to like open my eyes. And it was like the scariest, like I'm shaking thinking about it right now. And then I just kept trying to resist. And finally, like I woke up and I ran upstairs. And now I woke my mother up at the time and I told her what had happened and she's just like shocked, doesn't know how to react. And she's like, well, let's go get your brother and see how he's doing. And while we were walking downstairs, he's rushing upstairs and he's freaking out. And you know, we're like, what happened? And he's like, I just remember, sleeping and just feeling completely drained. And I could hear in the next room, a man, talking to Yaya about something. I couldn't understand what he was saying, but I heard how like deep his voice was and it freaked me out. I just was drained of energy. And then I woke up and ran upstairs. So take it how you want it, but that was the weirdest thing that has ever happened to me. And I think that what really validated it for me was the fact that my brother also heard what was going on in the other room. So I know something happened that night. I don't know exactly what it was, but I just wanted to say, like, I don't do drugs or like meth. I really don't even drink. So I just thought I would get it out there. And it was, it's kind of a weird story. So hard for me to like write it in an email on the side of the road, but I thought I'd let you guys know. I love your podcast. Keep it up. Thank you.
Yeah, that, I don't know. It seems like a creepy experience. I wouldn't want to go through that. Mm-hmm. I wonder if it happened any other time though, or something similar to that. She says that was pretty much it, but mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you think the brother was messing with her?
Oh, I don't know, but maybe we'll hear from the brother.
Ooh.
Also, I love that people are sending in audio files. If you would like to do that, we'd love to hear from you.
So I guess I want to follow that up. I've got three, okay. If you guys don't mind.
Yeah, yeah.
The first one is much along the same lines of Yaya's audio message. But I just kind of wanted to show that we got a pretty cool collection that looked at both, that's good examples of both sides of this sleep paralysis discussion.
Some variety.
So, yeah, a little variety. So here's one. It's from Jessica, and she describes her first experiences thus. First time I experienced sleep paralysis, I was taking a nap after class and preparing for a late shift at work. When I, quote, awoke, end quote, I couldn't move, but I could see my room as I was laying in my bed. I was on my side and could see multiple white shadows were quickly floating across my room back and forth and disappearing through the walls. I was petrified and wanted to run and scream, but could not move and had trouble breathing. At this point in my life, I had no idea what had happened and figured it was just a very, very vivid nightmare. A few weeks later, I had a similar episode. I was in the same exact position, except this time there was an attic door in the ceiling of my room. The attic door partly opened and things were being thrown out of it. And I even saw an arm. Again, very terrifying. And I couldn't move or make a sound. And my chest felt tight. It's a recurring thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something on your chest pressing down, mm-hmm. pushing the life out of you. Now that I look back at the situation, I don't know what to think of it. There were so many factors, scientific and supernatural, that affected my life. So now I want to, so I kind of wanted to follow up Matt's with this one, sort of that fear, terror kind of scenario. Mm-hmm. And now I've got a couple that sort of show a different angle on it.
Oh,
Largely because both of these folks report very specific sleep paralysis situations like we talked about, but they are kind of at peace with them. And I thought that was really interesting.
Oh,
so
wow.
This first one comes from George. And forgive me if I take on a bit of a voice when I read this.
He has wonderful,
very compelling prose here. Gentlemen.
Ooh, I like it.
I understand you live busy lives, so I will endeavor to keep this concise. My name is George, and I assume from the episode on sleep paralysis, you may be interested in a first-hand story on the matter. I'll start by saying this has happened to me many times, and I'm a firm believer it is just a crazy and amazing interplay between our brain and body. Some of my experiences have seemed very dark or sinister in nature, but it was only in the very beginning I thought they were otherworldly. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's a pretty long email, but I'm going to read his first example here. The first occurrence I can remember in sharp detail. I was 23 years old, living in San Diego and attending my sonar technical school, having been in the U.S. Navy for just over a year. It was like most of the classic stories. I felt fully awake and unable to move when I came to sense a dark intent in the room with me. I could feel something crawling up from the foot of my bed and very suddenly and intensely pressing down on my chest, as if trying to force all the air from my lungs and crush me.
Ugh.
The feeling of being completely immobile, suffering what you think is impending death, but at the same time fully mentally awake and screaming in your mind, is such a foreign experience in our mundane daily lives that it borders on the unexplainable. Simply said, it is terrifying on a level that makes you feel like a little child again, hoping your mother or father will rush in and chase away the darkness. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's where it gets interesting. To sum it all up, I am one of those weirdos that actually enjoys when this happens to me. George's words, not mine. I quickly dropped the notion that I was being haunted and grew to see it more as an extension of a lucid dreaming state, living in a place and time where everything has a logical purpose and science rules the day. It's fun to have the rules of reality bent a little because your brain thinks you are awake when you are really in a sleep limbo. Love the podcast. Respectfully, George.
I love that, George, because it makes me feel less bad about wanting to experience it.
And I think it's interesting because he sees both sides of the coin through experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he first has it and he can't explain it away and is probably leaning towards more of it being like a real, like a supernatural event of some kind. And then the more he experiences it, the more it starts to fascinate him. And then the more he realizes this is, you know, an extension of his mind and he is experiencing it and it's something that you wouldn't normally experience. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, he's not taking that for granted. And I think that's pretty awesome.
It's beautifully rational.
I
like George.
So for my second one, this person asked to remain anonymous. So I'm just going to read one of his or her experiences. I had my first shadow person experience when I was about 15 at a summer camp. I was sleeping in the top bunk in a room with 8 other people, and suddenly I opened my eyes and saw a black shadow floating over me. I was startled, but unlike the panicked reaction of many others, my next feeling was a complete certainty that this entity was watching over me like a mother and making sure I was okay. A second later, it dissolved away, and I went back to sleep. Another night at camp, I woke up very suddenly and saw a similar shadowy figure in the opposite corner of the room. I still get these once in a while, and it's strange, but I'm not afraid at all.
Nice. Don't be afraid.
I don't think so either. I mean, you know, you can look at it so many different ways, and I like this kind of guardian angel version of it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, even if it's associated with kind of a negative experience, I think it's interesting to be able to see both sides of something like that. That's why I liked George and this anonymous person's letters.
Wow. You know, when we did this episode, I didn't know that it would strike a chord with so many folks out there listening.
Some of the most YouTube comments we've ever gotten.
Really?
Yeah. Of people just saying, hey, yes, I've experienced this. I remember when this happened to me for the first time.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the podcast goes, the largest number of letters that I've seen generated from a single episode.
And unfortunately, now is the time. Matt, Noel, and I have to mosey on out of here. Well, I don't know. Are we going to mosey? Are we going to sneak?
No, I'm going to drive home as fast as I can. There is poop in my baby's diaper, and I can smell it from here.
Ew.
I need to change that diaper, you guys.
That's so weird, man.
What?
I mean, I get it, but it's just, you know.
You guys don't have that?
You need to get some sleep, buddy.
I've been changing my own diapers for years.
Oh.
No, but on a serious note, thank you so much to everybody who listened. Thank you even more to everybody who wrote in. If you would like to send an audio file, of a story, then please do. We'd love to check it out. All the stuff we said earlier applies. And the most important part of the show, do you have a topic idea for us? Is there something that you think is stuff they don't want you to know? This is your show as much as it is ours, and all of our best suggestions come from you. So go ahead and find us on the internet. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. Every like, every follow gets us a little bit further away from being fired.
Yes, absolutely. We are Conspiracy Stuff on most of those places. You can find us at stufftheydontwantyoutoknow.com. And if you want to send us an email, especially with an attachment of an audio file, you can send that to conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this topic and other unexplained phenomena, visit youtube.com/conspiracystuff. You can also get in touch on Twitter at the handle @conspiracystuff.